What's up, beautiful people, and welcome to Inside Out Empowerment, where we are examining the science of personal excellence through the very real experience of today's most powerful thinkers, professional athletes, and the world's greatest entrepreneurs. We learn the mechanisms for designing the life and the results of our dreams, starting from the inside out. I'm entrepreneur Joshua Nussbaum and your host. Just watch me now.
Tell me a little bit about like what your main grind is right now, what your day-to-day routine, not even routine, but like what is your day job at the moment?
My day job is my J-O-B. You know, I've been self-employed since 1980. So I've been really blessed with loving everything that I do in my career. So my day job, my career is a blend of speaking, training, consulting, writing, course creation, you know, all of those kinds of things. And a limited amount of mentoring, limited primarily because there are too many other things I'm have time to do more of that compared to earlier on in my career. And then the side piece for me is that there are a couple of nonprofits that I have leadership roles in that I devote time to as well, but those aren't things that I do to generate revenue.
Understood. Okay. And how have you experienced that transition aside from obviously, you know, getting more or less busy as your success level increases with, you know, you being known as a brand and a speaker and an author and a mentor? You know, generally the one-on-one consulting moves to small groups, moves to some degree of like a more formatted and formalized thing rather than, you know, in the beginning you get established helping a person or an entity, and then it expands and expands until you have like a system built out. It sounds like you're absolutely at that point where you have, you know, different modules that you can kind of like plug people into or different assets built that, you know, people can learn from. Aside from that part, have you seen it get easier or harder to get your information delivered? Obviously, with the mediums that we have right now, it's probably a whole hell of a lot easier. But with the ease and the lack of barrier to entry, there also comes a whole lot more competition and a lot more people attempting to do the like celebrity trainer or, you know, I'm a millionaire, look at my YouTube pre-roll thing going on and I can teach you to make money with penny stocks or I can like transform your organization from the inside out, right? So how have you personally and professionally kind of been impacted as the tide has changed? We were talking right before we press record about doing radio and you had your own radio show back in the day. And now, you know, my Boston Terriers can have their own podcast if they really felt so inclined, you know? Talk to me a little bit about what you've seen in the landscape of, you know, distribution and how that's affected you, considering you were prominent prior to the ease and the lack of barrier to entry. I mean, landing a radio show is a whole hell of a lot harder than launching a podcast, right? Even though podcasting is now much more prevalent in the day-to-day, I'm your guru entrepreneur type person.
Yes. Well, there has been a huge shift over time in my approach, in my strategies and my tactics because of what the internet has made possible. So back in the day, I was pretty much limited to a more local level of impact other than when I was brought to further away locations for doing keynotes and training programs. But I used to produce my own training programs, my own workshops, I used to have a monthly series back in the 1990s in San Diego called TGIFs for Healing People. It was the first Friday of every month from 5 in the afternoon until 7 in the evening. And we'd get, you know, an average of sometimes over 100 people, give or take 100 people each month. And it was the top of a sales funnel because people would pay a nominal amount. I think it was $10 back then for that. And then they had the option of signing up for the back then tape of the month club to get the recordings, and the recordings then started going viral and we started getting subscriptions from areas way beyond San Diego. Then the other part of that funnel was that people would then sign up for workshops.
How did something go viral in the 1990s? People would like put it in like a postcard and like mail it to other people, or how did things?
Yeah, it was a combination of word of mouth and also people making recordings of the recordings. So they would tape the tape and they would send the cassette off to somebody saying, you really got to listen to this. And they would contact us and say, how can I subscribe? So there was that. And then there was the workshops. We had our own workshop room in our office suite. So we would do smaller 1 to 2.5 day workshops and 6 week classes. So all of those things through word of mouth then funneled into the therapy and consulting parts of my career. I don't provide psychotherapy anymore. I'm not in town consistently enough to do that. That's kind of how that all rolled back in the day. It was all offline marketing that was based on word of mouth marketing.
It required your, instead of just your sales funnel being quality, it required the content once people opted in to be quality, because there wasn't just an endless sea of people that you could target with as low of a CPM. In fact, there probably wasn't even a CPM. Or would you pay radio spots in cost per listen, cost per thousand listens too? Or was it flat?
Never, ever did I do any paid marketing, ever.
Wow. Okay. Then there you go. Then it's the quality of what you're sharing that once people experience it, have the desire to share it. So why don't we back up for a second? Because I feel like we jumped in not at the beginning, which I tend to do quite frequently. Of all of my egregious strengths, one of them is not my organizational prowess. So who are you? What do you do? And like in like a minute or 2 minutes of what are you up to?
Sure. And I'm great with that. I often say to people when they say, I don't know where to start, I say, well, start in the middle and work your way out in both directions. So what I do is something that I've done for a long time, but I had not found the courage to own it fully because of how audacious it is. I help make integrity profitable, leadership effective, collaboration productive, happiness sustainable, and cultures healthy, all in an integrated way.
Wow. Okay. I like that very much. Those are some pretty massive promises or implications or claims right there. I assume none of these have been monitored by the FTC. Do we have to put a little like star next to what you do? It's funny. So we were talking on LinkedIn and he sent me over a list of, I'm talking to my audience for a second, right? You know, He sent me over a list of topics and I'm like, dude, I like every single one of those choices. Like every one of those are something like, forget for the audience standpoint or which fits the show the best. I'm like, I personally want to hear about each one of those. It sounds like, you know, he's like one of these OGs, one of these original gangsters that you could just like sit down with like this notepad that I have here and just get taken to school for days on end. So again, I'm not exactly sure where to start, but the one that I think caught my attention the most is the fake happiness formula or the faulty happiness formula. Because I feel like, you know, I feel with the nominal amount of success that I've been able to achieve, I personally have experienced it and I see it a lot in other people being like, if I can just get to X, then I will be happy. If everyone can just cooperate to a certain blah level or blah, blah, blah number or X amount of employees or Y amount of revenue or, you know, Z amount of sales or signups or whatever it is. And, you know, it almost works with the inverse that the more people I see somebody managing, the more hectic things are, the more, you know, turmoil and chaos and challenge and difficulty they have, which are things that really act as a deterrent for happiness. But a lot of the time are obviously, unless you're just a solo entrepreneur, they're necessary elements, you know, to be able to build an empire or at least an infrastructure, unless you're doing everything yourself, in which case comes with its own wave of overwhelm and difficulties and challenges. So why don't you talk to me a little bit about what the fault, and I'm wording it poorly, it's not in front of me right now, but I remember that one jumped up in my mind, is what is the faulty happiness formula? what is the predisposed misconception that people think is going to make them happy because of osmosis or the way the social construct is established?
Great lead-in. And before I describe the anatomy of the faulty happiness formula itself, there's something that you just said that is a perfect segue into that anatomy, and that is the belief that there are prerequisites to deserving to feel happy. Just like the belief that many people carry that they're deserving to feel love. And as soon as there are prerequisites that we have to meet, or we think we have to meet, then we have to figure out what those rules are that we need to follow in order to meet those prerequisites. And in order to follow those rules, we end up having to cover up parts of who we truly are, or thinking that we have to cover up parts of who we truly are. And we figure out that it seems like we need to manipulate others as well into molding them into being who they need to be in order for us to get what we want to get. It's a crazy making script. So with that as kind of the bridge between what you were talking about with prerequisites and the faulty happiness formula's anatomy, what that anatomy is the contrast between the original American dream that's mapped out very, very clearly in the U.S. Declaration of Independence and the Constitution versus the version of the American dream that got called the American dream. It never got called that in the Declaration of Independence or Constitution, but it got called that very deliberately in the 1950s. And the 1950s version of the American dream, which we are in end stage deterioration because of the unintended negative impacts of, is completely a bastardization of the original American dream.
So what are the two different American dreams? So the original is the right to liberty, pursuit of happiness. Was that the original American dream?
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is one way it's articulated. It's also articulated in a different form in America's mission statement, which most people don't know this country has a mission statement because it's not labeled with that term. It's called the prologue to the United States Constitution, but that's a mission statement.
That the we the people, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice and ensure domestic tranquility.
Right, okay. And that's the one. And then it maps out a vision, not only for happiness, but individual happiness, but for a happy society. And paraphrasing it, what it's mapping out is that the government is mandated to be a servant to its citizens, not to itself or to special interests, and is mandated to legislate, to function at the intersection of the seeming tension between personal freedom and the common good. Not one over the other, not one better than the other, both and navigating the tension between those two poles is what creates a happy society, according to the framers of the Constitution. And so if you can imagine a diagram that's a triangle or a pyramid, and at the top of the triangle, we have the phrase from the Declaration of Independence, the pursuit of happiness. And at the base, in each of the corners of the triangle, on one side is personal freedom, and the other side is social responsibility, the common good. So there's personal freedom and the common good and the pursuit of happiness. To succeed with the pursuit of happiness, we are operating in that ongoing dialogue between what's good for me and what's good for us all. And we're daring to navigate the tension between those two, because we don't live as an island. So that's the audacity of the original American dream formula. What got installed instead in the 1950s, and if you want to, we can go into the actually largely noble reasons why this was installed, but what got installed in the 1950s is that the pursuit of happiness at the top of the triangle got redefined as excessive consumption. Now, there's nothing wrong with loving stuff and things and adventures and vacations and fun. Nothing wrong with any of that. I actually happen to like a lot of those things. When happiness gets redefined as excessive consumption, that's where we have a faulty happiness formula. But it gets worse from there, because in the corners of the base of the triangle, the personal freedom corner got redefined as conformity. Conformity to the 1950s vision of what happiness was going to be, which was owning the house with the white picket fence and the two-car garage and having the 1.8 kids.
Yeah, the nuclear family unit post-World War II type.
Yes.
That we
paid. Yes.
Yeah.
And having the vacations and most of all, having all of the latest consumer appliances, keeping up with the Joneses.
Yep, that new vacuum, that second car, et cetera.
Yes.
Totally.
So that became the replacement for personal freedom. It was conformity to that version of what freedom allegedly was going to look like. And what social responsibility, what the common good got redefined as, was overwork. Because people, in order to make that delusion of the American dream work, people had to work longer and longer hours in a job they didn't necessarily love for a company whose values they didn't necessarily agree with in order to climb the corporate ladder in order to make more and more money, because they were essentially brainwashed into believing that the way they showed their family that they loved them was by providing them with the wherewithal to have all that stuff. That is the faulty happiness formula that got installed in the 1950s and has been creating incredible damage ever since.
Got it. Okay, so what is, I guess in a sentence, the essence of the faulty happiness formula is that things are going to make us feel good?
There are prerequisites to being happy.
Yeah, I have
and
that.
The prerequisites we have to meet are through having more and more and more and more as a bottomless pit.
Understood. So it's like consumerism at its worst.
Yes, rather than at its best.
Got it. So talk to me about, I'm assuming if you have the faulty happiness formula and you know what is wrong, what would a better version of that happiness formula that is more implementable look like?
Great. Perfect follow-up question, Joshua. So the sustainable happiness formula is actually built into our human nature. It's not something we have to create. It is something we have to realign with, but it's not something we have to build where there is nothing there. Our basic human nature is that as human beings, and what we haven't said on the show yet is that I'm a recovering psychologist. So my doctorate is in clinical and organizational development psychology. And so I've studied what creates sustainable happiness as part of my career. And it has to do with these three core drives. The drive to be who we truly are is the first drive. That's our drive for authenticity. The second drive is our drive to bond with others. That's our drive for connection. And the third drive is our drive to influence the world around us, which is our drive for impact. Why do I know, and why do psychologists in general know that this is our human nature? Because we see all three of these core drives in the youngest of children, in children versions of this. But they're just there in our nature.
And that's authenticity, connection, and impact?
Impact, right. Authenticity, connection, and impact. And the formula for sustainable happiness.
I can't relate to any of those.
Me either. Let's give up now. The thing that I found in looking at what made sustainably happy people sustainably happy was that they weren't focusing on one or two of those three core drives. They were actually living at the intersection of those three core drives. They reported feeling truly who they are and being bonded with people that were important to them, and having positive influence in whatever their chosen spheres of influence happened to be. It wasn't like mix and match. It was all three living together in an integrated way. That's the sustainable happiness formula, and it's our basic human nature.
So I imagine that there's things that people do that deviate or that invite deviation from this, right? Or I mean, people that feel like they're doing all three of these things are doing one in this circumstance, they're doing two in this circumstance, they're doing zero of the three over here in this circumstance. And what you're not even implying, what your notion is that all three of them should be prevalent and they should be living in the happy medium between impact, authenticity, and connection, where you're constantly in this song and dance that is, to a greater or lesser degree, playing with all, flirting with all three of those ideas in, I guess, most or all of, or as many as possible of your daily affairs. Am I hearing that correctly?
That's exactly right. That's what being an integral human being is. It's the integration of those three pulls in us, in the way we breathe and dance through our day.
I always thought integral meant important. Integral means integrated.
Yes.
Got it. Okay. An integral human being. Noted.
and there is a definition of integral meaning important. It's an integral to the nature of something.
Gotcha. Yeah. Cool. So what are steps that people take to be more, in your usage of the word, integral as it pertains to these three elements of the true happiness formula?
Sure.
Or what do you call it? What do you call it? Is it the real happiness formula, the effective happiness?
The sustainable happiness formula.
Sustainable. Thank you. There you go. Cool.
Yeah. Well, so first part of my answer is that we have to understand and then step into the anatomy of breaking free from spells, because the faulty happiness formula is a cultural societal spell that people either are under or have been largely exposed to and are fighting to not fall under. And in order to break free of a spell, three things have to happen. First of all, we have to recognize that we've been under a spell, or that there's an attempt to have us be under a spell. The second is we have to come to understand the spell's anatomy clearly and specifically enough so we can spot it when it's coming at us, or when it's getting reactivated from inside us through our programming from our past. And the third component is we have to have an alternative to that spell that is far more compelling than the spell is.
Why don't we start with, what has the spell been? Is that the fake, the faulty happiness formula? Is that like the assumptions of, we need prerequisites to be happy. We need prerequisites to be loved. We need certain things to occur before blah, blah, blah. Is that the spell? And then also the consumerism at its worst thing?
Yes. So the spell at the societal level is what we've been talking about. And then each of us has our own personal version, unique personal version of that. And the personal version of that that gets installed in childhood is what I call a survival plan. Because what is brilliant, absolute intuitive genius of us as children is intuitively being able to recognize that there's something more important than happiness, there's something more important than integrity as a child, and that's something that's more important is survival. Surviving what? Especially surviving experiences we have, not necessarily in our original family, could be in with our peers, could be anywhere, including but not necessarily, like I say, our original family, but experiences that we have that we don't know how to digest. We don't know how to turn into gifts and blessings. Instead, we carry this ever-growing backlog of unfinished business, of faulty learnings, of learnings that become self-sabotage scripts rather than learnings that expand our authenticity, lovingness, and impact, positive impact, rather.
So we're walking around a bunch of 2 and 3 year old versions of a jaded toddler, but just to a lesser degree. That we start putting the shit in the backpack that by a certain age is wearing us down and making us behave in ways that are survival oriented instead of thriving oriented.
Totally. And we do that as an expression of our innate genius, whose prime directive has to be channeled towards survival.
It's like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? It doesn't matter how much self-actualization you're lacking. If you don't have food, you need to feed yourself, right? It doesn't matter how hungry you are or how, bad your sex relations are. If you don't have oxygen, the first thing is to breathe, right? So you need to solve things further down the line where we're not worried about how is this going to impact the teenage version of me, or what program or system is running. We're just this thing hurts. and instead, and I need to be able to do something with it, assimilate it to what I already know, put it in its place so that I can, on a go-forward basis, be able to function and survive.
Yes. And the biggest piece of that that hurts is we don't feel loved in ways that feel like love to us often enough.
Tell me about that. What do you mean?
What I mean is that when we grow up with, and again, this might, what I'm about to describe might be in our family in part or not at all, and it can be all other places too. When we grow up with violation instead of what feels like connection, when we grow up with abandonment instead of what feels like connection, when we grow up with people stealing the attention from us, big people, grown-ups stealing the attention, when we grow up with being indulged instead of connected with.
Come on, that's the American dream, dude. That's how you tell people you love them.
Exactly. That's the American nightmare right there. Well, those things don't feel like love. There are lots of things that are indeed, in fact, loving to offer a child, like obvious things like, you know, food and clothing and shelter and education and health, you know, obviously. The things that register as love to a child are very specific, very limited. Connection, heart connection, validation, not indulgence, validation, I see you, and safety, emotional safety. Those are the things that feel like love to children.
I'm like, am I making an outline for my show notes or am I taking notes on how to handle Noah, my 9-year-old? I'm not entirely sure. Maybe both.
There you are. Both and.
Both and. I like that. I say to employees all the time, instead of and or, how to create an and. You know, like if you are deciding between two things, it 99% of the time is reflective of your frame of reference being too small. There is 99.99999% of the time an ability to accomplish both things that in your mind seem to be juxtaposed.
Right on, Joshua. I'm a confirmed bothist.
Bothist. I like it. That we deviated though. I'm sorry. So
that's okay. So coming back.
So that's how you show actual love. That's how that registers as love.
That's what registers as love over and above all the other things that are in fact loving to offer. And when we most need love is when we're experiencing a life experience that we don't know how to digest and use in a good way. So when we're not experiencing love in those forms that feel like love to us enough of the time, we have to develop a survival plan, a way of like we were saying, housing or carrying those undigested life experiences. And the starting place of that is what I call a happy ending fantasy. And the happy ending fantasy says something very, very simple.
I assume you're not referring to like the massage type happy ending.
No, I'm not referring to the massage happy ending, if for those of our listeners who know what we're referring to. All right. Is this a G-rated show? And so the happy ending fantasy is very, very simple.
Ladies and gentlemen, look at that train of thought. That's impressive. That's impressive train of thought right there. I tried to throw him a curveball. Nope, right back on track. You're an animal. You're a robot.
I'm an OG. I'm the other kind of OG, an old guy.
An old guy. That's so funny. So we just hired back a girl. Her name is Brittany to help us plan for Olympia, which is like, you know, the Super Bowl of like bodybuilding and physique and bikini competition, right? It's in September out in Vegas for Rev Labs. We were saying that her and Liz, my fiance, are the OGs. And she's like, what, the old girls? And I'm like, they mean original gangsters, but that's the second time in like 3 days that joke has been like presented to me. I'm like, fuck, I gotta start saying original gangster. So like OG doesn't just mean calling somebody old, because that's the way
exactly
getting perceived. I meant it lovingly, and then you took it as
oh no, I heard it lovingly. I just wanted to find a time to zing that one in.
I feel you.
So this happy ending fantasy.
Yes, yes.
There's more love here than I'm getting.
Okay.
There's more love here than I'm getting. Now, that's the beginning of the survival plan, because as long as I believe that there's more love available than what's feeling like love to me, I'm able to keep going. But imagine for a moment what would happen to a child if their innate genius to invent that story didn't kick into place, and they were sitting there as a 2-year-old, a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, saying to themselves,
feeling like shit and saying, this is the extent of anything life has to offer.
Yeah.
It's scary.
Where does that take right. a kid that's 3 or 4 or 5 years old?
Feeling suicidal or?
Yeah, not, damn right.
Not having a drive to outcreate their current circumstance. I mean, some scary propositions.
Exactly. And so a lot of people as adults end up beating themselves up for having developed a survival plan. And when I say to them, oh my God, no, you were a fucking genius. You were just simply using your innate genius intuitively to construct a survival plan. Good on you.
You should create an Alexa skill that tells people that on a daily basis, that just like they turn it on and it's like, you, oh, you're feeling strain. You're feeling this. You're feeling that. You are a fucking genius. Now let's fix that.
Yes, exactly. You got it. And so as soon as we embrace that notion that there's more love here than I'm getting, that's when the prerequisites kick in. That's when we have to go out on this quest to figure out and then follow whatever rules we're supposed to follow in order to get that love.
Got it. Got it.
So, and that's the second component of a survival plan, is the rules.
So I feel like it might be faulty, but there's also a lot of truth to it too, right? Because like somebody, a child might be experiencing something that is painful or is misrepresentative of how much they are loved, inaccurately representative. And to think, you know, there is more love here than I am feeling or than I am experiencing or than I'm perceiving may very well be an accurate notion, right? I understand that it can lead to unhealthy things, or like, you know, the prerequisite to the notion that there are prerequisites to be loved, or all of this stuff that may or may not be serving them in the long run, but it also seems accurate, right?
The level on which it's accurate is the level on which our search for those rules ends up in us feeling more of who we are, being more of who we are, more authentic, feeling more connected and bonded with others, and feeling like we have more positive impact in whatever areas of the world we want to be having positive impact. So to the extent that this is a true thing, we can measure that by results. If what we're learning helps us be more of who we truly are, more bonded with others, and more positively impactful, then we're learning good stuff. Most of us learn a blend of that stuff and the stuff we have to later on outgrow. And in the survival plan, the stuff you were just asking about, Joshua, that stuff, those learnings aren't part of a survival plan. That's a foundation of a thriving plan, right? But in the survival plan, the rules that we have to figure out and follow are rules about two things. What do we have to cover up or change in us in order to get that love? And the second is, how do we have to make life easier or more comfortable for the people around us so we will get that love? And if at worst, how do we have to contain them in order to get that love? So in order to obey, in order to follow the rules we're figuring out, we have to shove parts of who we are into what I call a Pandora's box, into a hiding place inside us. And those things that we shove into a hiding place inside us, those things are not only things we judge as bad or evil or wrong. They're also parts of us that are parts of our light that we are learning is too much for the people around us.
So that one has never landed hard with me. You know, I've done a lot of leadership seminars and courses and a lot of like, you know, explorative, you know, journeys to self. And, you know, that's something that has shown up a lot for Liz, who's second in command here at Rev Labs and runs our Vegas portfolio and is my fiance. And ironically, we're responsible for very, very different pieces of the organizations. Dimming her, like me, I've always been like, you know, I'm strong at this. I'm good at this. I'm going to, you know, push in this direction. I want to, you know, embrace this strength and, you know, shine a light through it. So it kind of kaleidoscopes and turns into something else. Right. And she's been very much like, I don't want to make those people comfortable. I don't want to be too good. I have something else to add to it. I'm going to keep it to myself. And she's dimming her own light or suppressing different elements that I think are what you're saying, putting the good stuff into Pandora's box as well, is something that she relates to a lot better than I do. Give me examples of like where you see people taking a piece that serves them and putting it into Pandora's box and why somebody might do that.
So what a lot of us guys do instead of what I was describing is that we will take portions of our giftedness, our strengths, our light, and we will blow those parts of who we truly are up to where we're over depending on those talents of ours, hoping that, right? Self-confidence is golden. But if we're over-relying on self-confidence, we will fake self-confidence or we'll blow up our self-confidence to make it seem bigger than it actually is. And that's over-reliance on a gift. That's a survival skill too.
Yeah. So where is, I don't know if I heard the answer to this or if it was when I paused us for a second. Where are people taking the parts of their personality that are not just the bad parts? Like I have to hide the fact that I, you know, fart a lot and I need to not fart a lot in order to be loved or something, right? That would be like something that doesn't really serve you and that you've made part of your story. But you said that, you know, people take positive parts or pieces of like their light or their gifts and shove those into Pandora's box as well. What are examples of somebody doing that?
Well, okay. So there were very precious, heart-connected parts of me, tender places in me that are really incredibly important for connecting with others in a truly authentic way that I shoved in my Pandora's box to protect myself. I became a heart hider.
Got it. So I get you turning down your connectivity or your vulnerability with like the very silly guys that, I mean, people have this thing that like, if they're not vulnerable, like they somehow confuse that to being like impervious to pain, which is such bullshit. Cause like if you wear your heart on your sleeve or you're open with people or you're connective with people, life's gonna hurt either way. Whether you are open with it or you're closed with it, like, okay, fine. So you walk around like a shell of a human, not like exposing any of your real self to people, like that's somehow fucking fulfilling and makes life not hurt. Life is going to hurt, period. It's like people have like a fear of failure, so they don't act. I'm like, well, I got good news and bad news for you. The bad news is that you're going to fail whether or not you try at this thing. The good news is that you're going to fail whether or not you try at this thing. So you have nothing to lose. Like you have a fear of failure. So it's creating this paralysis. Well, you're going to fail in life no matter what you do or don't do. It is a simple truism. And you're going to hurt in life whether or not you authentically are exposing yourself to people. You know, so it's that's another weird little trap or programmed thing, a piece of the script we have written for ourselves, and obviously to a greater or lesser degree on a personal level, depending on like who we are and our backgrounds and our experiences and what has, you know, what our perception has been of like which ones have threatened our survival or our, you know, there's more love available thing that runs. I know I'm a listener. It's weird. That's a really good example of something somebody would do, being a heart hider or tuning back their receptivity to connectivity or to connection or to authentic, like this is who I am, because they don't want to expose the sensitive elements of who and what they are.
Yes. There's a saying from three volume, well, plus a couple of addendums work called A Course in Miracles. And the line is, "In my vulnerability, my safety lies." It's deliberately talking about the paradox that you were just talking about, that there is nothing really to be gained by being invulnerable. We really don't make ourselves safer by being invulnerable. We actually make ourselves safer by supporting ourselves in our vulnerability.
And at least that way, when something hurts, you can experience the hurt and you can continue to be a self-cleansing oven where the feeling comes in, the feeling goes out, the feeling is generated, the feeling is expressed, the feeling is released, instead of a constant, this is how I'm feeling. This is my filter of what I'm allowed to feel. Let these feelings through and turn these down a different suppressed trunk in the attic that will not be looked at or toyed with until it the demons are making so much noise that I have to look at it because I can't function in my house with that racket going on upstairs.
And that's exactly the problem, Joshua. Feelings are never buried dead. They're always buried alive.
That is a very graphic analogy and I like it. It's accurate though. Yeah. You suppress the shit. It's not, it doesn't just go away.
It's just going to come out sideways. And we will be the last ones to know that we're leaking. Other people will see it, that stuff in us faster than we'll see it in ourselves.
Okay.
So back to the Pandora's box that we were talking about. I was saying that I learned part of what I put in my Pandora's box was parts of my heart. So I learned how to be a heart hider. And then what I did as a compensation was that I started to over rely more and more and more on my head, started to require my head to handle stuff that only my heart is designed to handle.
Like relationships with people?
Yeah. Like relationships with people, like thinking my way through situations where feelings were involved and I'm busy pushing the feelings away and I'm trying to fix the situation. So I'm I was a typical male fixer. You got a feeling, you're dealing with an uncomfortable emotion. Let me see how I can fix that for you. And I'll call that love. Meanwhile, that person wasn't feeling loved by my doing that for them.
Makes perfect, perfect sense. Again, I can't relate to any of this personally, but yeah. I can imagine what it would be like.
Yeah, yeah. Me too. I'm just talking theoretically.
Yeah.
So, and this then ties into another part of what you were saying, Joshua, because when we have that happy ending fantasy, there's more love here than I'm experiencing. And then we set out to figure out and follow the rules. And in figuring out those rules, we figure out what to shove away into hiding. What we then end up with is a persona, a mask. And a mask is a blend of authentic parts of ourselves, authentic gifts, talents, skills that are being overused, and cover-ups that are designed to hopefully prevent people from seeing the stuff that we've hidden away.
Yep. Or make the mask more palatable, or make the...
Exactly. Exactly.
...well-received or whatever.
And that's the fourth part of the fourth ingredient in our survival plan. There's one final ingredient to round out the picture. Because think about, now we're children inventing this stuff intuitively. We're not waking up in the morning and saying to ourselves, all right, what's a happy ending fantasy that I have to create? And what are the rules? And we're doing this with our intuitive genius. And doing all of this is a fuckload of work. It's a lot of work. And worse than that, no matter how hard we try to make it work, it always falls short.
It will never work. Yeah. Because we're chasing something on a faulty premise. The finish line is not there, that there's more to be had if we produce X, Y, and Z money or behavior or perception or enough humor, or we just get our excessive farting under control, then we will be loved. But
exactly.
Okay, so these are all the elements that do not create the sustainable happiness.
This is the faulty happiness formula that needs to be rounded out with the fifth ingredient.
Okay.
Anesthesia. We have to find ways to numb the pain that we have because we're turning ourselves into a pretzel. And no matter how much we turn ourselves into a pretzel, we still don't meet those impossible to meet prerequisites for happiness and lovability.
Dude, I love what you're saying. I think it's very sophisticated concepts put very simply.
Thank you.
I think they're profound, but it's like the simple, but not easy. Right. It's like, I'm kind of sitting here going, and we'll get to this in a second, but like, what the fuck do we do about it? What are the pragmatic walkthroughs? I mean, let's not get quite there yet. So what are things that people do to numb out? Is this like the drinking, this excessive sleeping, the like just any escape that somebody has that may or may not be productive, but things that make the turning into a pretzel or bending outside of your comfort zone more palatable for yourself to be able to tolerate? Is that what that is?
Yeah. Anything in the whole wide world can be used for the purpose of anesthesia if that's the intention. So in your world, in the bodybuilding world, there are individuals, and I'm sure you know plenty of them, that are in that world because it is their calling. It is their heart's passion. It's crucial, precious parts of their authenticity expressing themselves. And then there are other people in that world who are over-exercising and over-bodybuilding and over-nutritionalizing themselves as a hiding strategy. So anything, including the most wonderful things in the world, could be used for the purpose of anesthesia if that's what the intention is.
Got it. I generally close my episodes by asking for a pragmatic step that people can take towards empowering their life. I'm not kicking you off the show, but you did say we had about 30 minutes, and take as long as you want on this one. I feel like we developed a lot of what the issue is and where the fuck it comes from. What does somebody actively do about it now? I'm 32 years old. I've put a couple million bucks in the bank. I've had a failed marriage. I have a relationship that by all intents and purposes is going great now. I think I'm a pretty killer dad, although it comes with a shit ton of challenges. I have employee ups and employee downs. I have some days where I'm feeling at peace and some days where I'm feeling like, God, I want to kick everyone's ass, including my own, and things need to change. And then I turn the microphone on and I, you know, go at it from that perspective, but it's a little bit of a lot all over the place. And what you're talking about seems to be an integral, in your usage of the word, human being that seems to just be naturally sort of existing in this well-balanced, touching connection and authenticity and impactfulness inside them and around them at all times. How does somebody work towards doing that?
Excellent. So on a practical level, what the entire self-development journey is this dance between outgrow and upgrade, outgrow and upgrade. So the first practical step, which is not really where the rubber meets the road, but it's the foundation that allows the rubber to meet the road, is we have to become willing to recognize that to one extent or another, we've been undermining ourselves as adults because we are still remaining loyal to a childhood survival formula that we don't fully grasp. And that's why it's running us to whatever extent it's running us. So the first practical step is to learn how to spot the faulty happiness formula, the faulty love formula that's controlling us, that's running us to whatever extent it's running us as an adult.
So give me an example of what that would look like.
Sure. I'll give you two examples or two specifics. One telltale sign is that we need to watch for our inner critic, the part of us that shames us and blames others. That's always never, never satisfied. No matter what we or others do, it's never good enough. There's always something to criticize. So looking for the inner critic is a telltale sign that our survival plan has us by the balls or by the lady balls.
Yeah, I knew they were proverbial balls, not physical balls.
Yes. The other telltale sign is anesthesia. Are we using things that could be absolutely lovely things in order to run, in order to numb the feelings that we don't want to know that we're having, or we know we're having, and we don't feel equipped to know how to deal with? So looking for the telltale signs that tell us, oh yeah, there's something here to outgrow. Oh, there's a third telltale sign too, Joshua. When we tell ourselves this here and now situation is just like blank from the past.
Got it.
We are projecting our unfinished business from the past onto this current situation. And there may be some truth to that, our projection, because we may have unknowingly orchestrated the current situation to hurt just right.
I like that. Orchestrated something that's fucked up, that was unpleasant, so that at least the pain is a familiar type of pain.
Yeah, it may be hell, but it's home.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. I know how to suffer this way.
Remember the ballad of Jack and Diane, life goes on long after the thrill of living is gone?
Uh-huh.
Oh, please, that's not a way to live. That's a way to survive, yeah, but it's not a way to live.
Touche. So, okay, so we start feeling one of these like telltale signs creeping up, right? Like we see the pattern running, or we notice that we're anesthetizing. Is that the right word?
Yeah.
We're engaging in some sort of like anesthesia to make something tolerable, or anesthetizing ourselves in some capacity, or we're projecting a past thing onto an existing thing and we start to catch it. That's recognizing the pattern. Then what?
Then we allow ourselves to shift into inviting that to be a wake-up call. Instead of making all of that stuff wrong, we say to ourselves, ah, this is happening because the deeper wisdom inside me is wanting to alert me to something that needs my attention that I've been trying to sidestep. I wonder what that is. So we become teachable.
Okay. So that definitely ups our willingness.
Yes.
And I guess it would increase our clarity. You know, the first step in resolving a problem is admitting you have one, right?
Right.
Then what the fuck do we do about it pragmatically? Once we see that the painful something is rearing its ugly head, or, you know what, maybe I never really did handle the divorce the first time around and that requires another look. Or, okay, I acknowledge I got fucked in this business deal, but not every single person that's trying to make a deal with me is trying to look for an angle to screw me over, right? So you see like old processes running somehow.
Yeah.
And become aware of it. And then what? We become teachable. What's the next step?
The next step is that once we become teachable, we set aside the automatic program to numb ourselves up or to try to reduce our pain level. And instead, what we focus on is asking ourselves, what have I been trying to sidestep? What have I been hoping that I could get away with not dealing with, that this situation is telling me otherwise?
Yeah, you know something that was running for a long time with me, and I say that like it's a past thing, it still is my knee jerk of how I want to handle things, is like when I lose hard or when I'm hurting, my knee jerk reaction is to go produce like a motherfucker. Is to like outproduce any feeling with production and with winning and with scoring and with money and with, you know, I think money is not really my primary way that I win, but it is still a very good scorecard. You know, they, you know, joke around, you know, when I was in like high school and college, you go through a breakup, they're like, dude, you just got to go bang it out, you know, go hook up with three chicks or five chicks or whatever till you can't remember her name. You know, I feel like every time I lose, I turn around and like, let me go win really, really, really hard at things that I know I'm good at, to not have to like mourn the loss of, and I don't think people should lament. And part of this is probably healthy. Part of it is probably just that mechanism that runs because I like the feeling of winning, you know, as I've been applying what you're saying to myself. And I think a big one that runs for me is like just jumping back into overproduction mode instead of just being like, yeah, I lost, or yes, I got screwed, and it's okay to feel how I'm feeling right now.
Right, right. And so that's classic survival plan kicking into overdrive. And the solution that the survival plan says is, if I overproduce, everything will be okay. Well, that means what I'm running from is the secret knowledge that feels too impossible to really ever deal with, which is, I'll never be good enough. I'll never be good enough. I'll never be enough. I'll never be lovable. I'll never be successful. I'll never be fill in the blank. And that's the delusion that the survival plan revolves around, because it believes
it is built on the delusion, or that there is a prerequisite that more needs to happen prior to being enough right now.
Bingo. Perfect. So as soon as I bust myself, as soon as I call myself on that fact, oh, I slipped back into that delusion that there are prerequisites, I'm now tempted to pretend as though that delusion is true. Now what I can do is finally address the unfinished business that has activated that in me in the first place.
That mechanism, yeah.
And if I can't find the unfinished business, I can look at the seven core life skills that are part of the anatomy of sustainable happiness that are completely different from the five core skills I just went over that are the anatomy of the survival plan. And that's what we could cover in a follow-up interview.
Let's do that as part number two. I like that very much. But the first step is to identify the shortcomings. Real quick, plug all your stuff. If somebody wants to hear more of you, wants to see more of you, wants to feel more of your impact, how do they connect with you?
Authentic. Sure.
Did I get all of them? I got authentic in there, and I got connection
and impact.
Impact. And I did try to do it in a way that was cohesive instead of just bulleted.
Thank you. I'll give people a couple of options depending on what they want to know next. So if you want to learn more about me and the range of things that I provide, go to drgruder.com. That's drgruder.com. If you want to learn more about the societal spell that we've been under, go to hijackingofhappiness.com, where on the homepage you can see my TED talk on that topic.
Spell hijacking?
Hijacking, hijacking of happiness, all one word, .com. If you want to know, if you want to get on the notification list for the online course that I'm going to be launching soon, that's on all of what we're touching on, then go to drgruder.com/having it all, because there really is a way to have it all. But it's only possible, it only becomes available to us once we've broken free of the delusional spell of what having it all allegedly means. So if you want to get on the notification list, and if you're listening to this video after that online course is launched, then drgruder.com/having it all will automatically forward you directly into that course information.
Beautiful. And what if somebody wants to reach out to you directly? Do you have an email or social platforms? I know you reached out to me originally on LinkedIn. What is your perform method of communication?
So, yeah, I mean, you can connect with me through any of the major social networks. You know, just type in my name and it'll show up. There are only two David Gruders on the planet. And the other one is a fellow in Canada. And probably a long-lost relative. We've been in touch and we're trying to figure out if there's common heritage, because the last name Gruder is very unusual, at least in the Western world it is. But the main way to be in touch with me is that at the bottom of each page on drgruder.com is a blue contact button. You click on that contact button and you can either send me a message or you can set up a meeting with me if that's an appropriate thing to do. So that's the best way to do it.
Awesome. Dr. Gruder, David. I have a partner named David. I call him Davey Baby. You strike me less than a Davey Baby than he does, but Dave. Thank you so much for your time, effort, and energy. I know that the recording was a little bit spontaneous. I'm here without the microphone or the headphones, and I hope that the sound quality turned out well. But I think I have a feeling this is going to be the first of many, and I very much appreciate your time.
I appreciate yours. Thanks for having me on the show, actually. And I look forward to more. And I do too. I hope that this recording came out well enough so that we're able to have your listeners benefit from it.
100%.
Awesome.
Bye-bye.
Inside Out Empowerment is written and produced by me, Joshua Nussbaum. But when it comes to all things editing, mixing, mastering, I have to give hats off
Resonate Recordings has been amazing to work with. If you have a podcast or you're thinking about starting a podcast, I knew I had a bunch of stuff I wanted to say, didn't really know how I was going to go about putting it into podcast format, get it into an RSS feed, upload it to iTunes, all that stuff. And the owner of Resonate Recordings, Jacob, has really stepped up to the plate. Go ahead and mention Inside Out Empowerment when you talk to them, and you'll get your first episode mixed and mastered for free. If you guys are looking to level up your life and be entertained in the process, go ahead and subscribe so you don't miss my weekly podcast. I'm highly responsive. Please, I'm going to leave the show notes below, complete with all the ways you can connect with me on Instagram at RevLabsPrez, on YouTube at Joshua Nussbaum. This is here for you guys. Please reach out, connect, like, comment, subscribe, ask me questions, tag me. I'm here for you. Let's tailor this bad boy and live an empowered life. Talk soon. Just watch me now. Just watch me now.